this episode, we have the fabulous Kemi Johnson on to chat with us. Kemi is a mother, birth keeper in the birthroom, birth educator and birth activist. Formerly an independent midwife registered in the UK, she is now freely following her calling to facilitate healthy, ecstatic births for mothers, people and their babies. We chat with Kemi about home birth, free birth and why the reported outcomes can often be misunderstood. We look at induction and childbirth outcomes, time frames in birth, as well as breech birth. We find out why Kemi left midwifery and started speaking out, her thoughts on becoming a safe midwife and working as an independent birth keeper. We talk tough about the difficulty midwives and doulas are currently facing in our maternity systems. We look at the trauma encountered from working in the current birth space and how we can best serve families as birth keepers and protectors whilst maintaining our own health. This will be a brilliant but tough listen at times. However, a conversation we need to be having and acknowledging. Before I let you jump into this episode, I do need to apologise for the terrible sound quality from my own microphone. I was not recording this at home, but instead in my mother's spare room without my totally awesome podcast mic. I had checked the other mic before I went on holiday, but clearly it didn't quite work out as planned. I have tried all the editing skills I know of, and my goodness, has this episode taken me some editing hours. So I'm just going to say a little sorry to your ear rolls. You will also hear the other palavers with recording in the bloopers. So now's the time to sit back and relax with that cup of tea or put on your runners and get ready for your walk and enjoy this episode. I'm Katie James and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host.
Oh my God, you two, come on. Come on. You know, there were some very good reasons why you're my favourite podcast. I swear, I listen to a lot of podcasts. And
bollocks isn't a swear word.
And then I heard you guys and I thought, oh, that would be me if I had a podcast. I haven't got a podcast yet, but I'm in the bones of creating one.
Right.
You've just given me that impetus to just get out there with fully me.
Yes.
But at the same time, dropping gems of knowledge, like gems, pure knowledge. Shall we just flow? And then you can pick out 5 minutes that's worth. Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to the show. Bang. Go.
I flow. So, Rachel, I'm not sure if you are aware that when Katie invited me on, I'm like, what? Why? I realised that my voice is beneficial in this arena of assisting families, and also now it's kind of getting reflected back to me that it seems to be influential. So I thought, yeah, there may be a couple of people that will listen to this episode of the podcast.
I reckon.
I'm sure there'll be more than a couple.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got lots of choice. Like, you know, I'm still in awe about you having Sarah Buckley on, Lily Nichols. Like, oh my God.
I know.
Only the best get on here.
Sarah Wickham. Who I've got almost as big a crush on as I have Rachel Reed. Okay?
Almost.
See, almost as big a crush as what I have on Rachel Reed. So I feel really that the conversation that we're going to have can't help but have a beneficial effect on some families, because I think I was in the noughties, training as a student midwife, and I just remember looking at so many situations. I mean, the worst one was when somebody, a mentor, was pulling the cord over a baby's head when the baby's head was born. I'd already read, you know, I'd been reading because I am fully obsessed. Like, you know, it's a problem to have a romantic relationship. I'm fully obsessed. So I already knew that best practice was to not do that. But I'm being mentored, aren't I?
Yeah.
I'm seeing a hand go to reach for the umbilical cord and I'm thinking, nah, she's not going to do that. Hey, she's going to do that. It's not best practice. What's the point? Baby's got this far. The rest of the baby can be born. Hence, you know, I think that was the beginning of the big crush on Rachel when she was talking about the somersault maneuver. Okay. So, yeah. And all about this. And then she reaches and she pulls the cord over the baby's head. And then I just see blood all over the place because, of course, she did detach the umbilical cord from the umbilicus, didn't she?
Oh, God.
And it was terrible. And she took a while to notice. And I took a while to say, because I was trying to figure out what was going on. And, of course, the baby had to go for head cooling. And, of course, the prognosis was, you know, we'll have to see how the baby is in a year. Yep. But it was good for me to see. It was good for me to see because, you know, the following year, they assessed that I was worthy of being on the register. So I needed to see what not to do. So I can say definitely that in my training, I saw a lot of what not to do. A lot of it. That was the worst bit. And then I'd have my head in my hands and I'd say, God, these people are so stupid. I'm sorry. It wasn't a judgment. It's literally, oh my God, and they're in charge of lives. Like, and then I started reading midwife thinking and that's better. It was a big exhale. Because I thought, oh, right, I'm not mad or wrong or pie in the sky or woo. There actually is a better way than what I'm being shown and what's being perpetuated. So I started going off piste fully from there. I just needed somebody to say, you're not mad.
Yeah, you're not alone.
You're not alone, exactly. So, you know, I've been reading Sarah Sherwood. She was an independent midwife. And then, you know, then I just started to find more and more and found also that, you know, Google, it's really easy to find the wrong advice.
From
clinicians, you know, from academics. So, you know, and it's all out there as if it's right. So it's no wonder there are so many parents that are thinking, well, they must know what they're doing and then ending up in horrific situations. So that kind of eventually persuaded me that there's a social media, I may as well be on it and keep my mouth off. And so I started to do that.
How long have you been doing it now?
So I'd say I've been running my mouth for about 11 years. And and then kind of kicked it up a notch when I took myself off the register, which you might find interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
I then kicked it up a notch because, and it's so funny. It's lovely, actually. I got a message on, you know, on Facebook, you can get messages from people that you don't know. You've got like an other box. And so I thought, I'm just going to go, oh, you didn't know? The episode, Kate is going to be checking her other box. Rachel's going to be checking her WhatsApp. So I was in my other box and there was a midwife that she wasn't happy with stuff I'd been saying. And then she pulled out her ACE card, which is, I think I need to report you to the Nursing and Midwifery Council.
What?
And I went, hooray! It doesn't matter. And actually, so I've been off the register now, it'll be coming up to 2 years. And actually, I think that I have been more of a positive influence since I've come off the register in people's births. Like, it's like a landslide of positivity, as well as me attending births. you might be interested in that as a birth keeper. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely, it was definitely the right thing for me to do. And, you know, it's not right for everyone. And it took me 2 years to do it. And on the day when I deregistered, my hands were shaking and I was crying buckets when I did it. So it's just strange that, you know, I was thinking, yeah, I worked so hard for something, and I have to let it go to be a good midwife.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, wow. I can't imagine. That's huge.
Yeah.
To have to, like, it's really like I'm signing the paper. I've worked so hard to get here. I've been working in it. I've been challenging it. I've been trying my hardest to change it whilst in the system. And there was obviously this gut feeling that was like, I can do more when I'm not in it. But it's making that leap, which is sometimes the hardest thing.
It was so, so hard. It's like even, you know, I remember there was a lot of pushback on us being in social media as midwives. You know, they're really trying. I mean, obviously, it's like putting a hand over holes in a hose, you know, the energy just pops up somewhere else. And they've clearly not succeeded. Like, we're out there. But imagine if you guys weren't assembling the people that you did for this podcast. There'd be so many more parents in the dark about what's possible. When you guys had the, you know, groundbreaking conversations about gestational diabetes and, you know, from the mother's perspective and the baby's perspective, it's information that parents need to know. But in a way, you know, you don't, you're humble and funny and so really listenable. You can cut that bit out.
No, I was like, you don't have to say that. Thanks.
That's what I'm saying. I just feel, you know, like the famous put down for parents. Oh, where'd you get that, Dr. Google or Dr. Instagram? You know, actually, the truth is that parents are actually getting the truth there.
Yeah, I mean, it's accessible medium. And if we continue in the dark ages, and there's so many people who haven't got time or don't want to read, or they have a pile of pregnancy books they don't read, and then they're out of date, possibly. And then, you know, in our current systems, where is the time given for midwives to sit and talk with women?
Yeah.
I mean, I worked in, the biggest thing for me was really when I worked in a specialist service for women with alcohol, drug, severe mental health problems. So you can imagine the time for a booking just to gain trust and find out what was happening in their sort of their life so I could link them with the right people. I hadn't even got to the point about pregnancy or booking. And that was then being said, we need to cut this from an hour and 20 to an hour. And then it was like, we need to go back to 40 minutes, which all the other midwives are doing. And I just was like, you've got to be kidding. It takes 40 minutes before I've even got the trust that I can then start thinking, okay, I need a social worker. I need the addiction specialist. I need this person. Oh, and this has come out, which they hadn't put down. Oh, and suddenly because they've trust me, they're telling me about this. We're in an hour. It's almost like I haven't done blood pressure. I haven't done any of this. No. And of course, they're booking in late most of the time because of the fear of joining the service. And to bring this down to these, you know, 10-minute, 20-minute, not even appointments to try and get in any kind of psychological well-being discussion and have that continuity where you go, do you know what? I saw you a couple of weeks ago. Are you all right? What's going on?
Yeah.
All it's the things, not there.
It's not there. And those are all the things that essentially, like looking at my cohort of families that I've looked after and all of the nuance in that relationship that I have with them, because it continues, isn't it? And where they're coming from and their history and their obstetric history and their medical history and bringing all of that together and then having someone of a raised BMI having a water birth at home after two cesareans and then finding, oh my gosh, it all went really well and her blood isn't on the floor and the baby's at the boob and she's ecstatic for decades. You know, you see those outcomes come from circumstances where if she had been plugged into the established maternity system and denied a water birth because of her BMI and the VBAC and not having continuous monitoring and all the rest of it, or having continuous monitoring, would produce different results. It does. It does. We see it all the time. But us home birth midwives are kind of like the lowest of the low. No one wants to hear what we've got to say. And, you know, the result is that we're just ending up with more and more weird outcomes that are attributed to us because she was fat. You know, it's not because you denied her right to get comfort in any way that she chooses, wherever she wants.
Because we make assumptions and we have biases against many women within the system. Unfortunately, that is still existing.
It still exists. So I've noticed that we've all had these conversations. Some people have put their money where their mouth is and set up their blogs and written their books and everything else. We've had, look at all the academic information that's coming to us around maternity and childbirth outcomes. And even now we've got long-term studies, you know, that amazing work done by Hannah Darlan on induction and, you know, outcomes for 16-year-olds, etc. She just went all the way in, spent what, a decade? Yeah.
Yep.
It lands, everyone goes, oh, that's so nice. Sweep it under the carpet. And then we go on to have, in the UK anyway, absolute worst induction rates and cesarean rates we've ever had.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
So,
I think that's global.
It's global.
I think that's
right. I mean, I comment about the UK. You know, I'm a South Londoner. UK, right? But yeah, I'm looking at everywhere, the US particularly. Mm. You know, it's a wrap for some of the other countries where you've got 90% cesarean rates, etc. But it's, for me anyway, just to interject, I think this is important for people to know. I personally have embraced that I know now that the answer to making birth better will not be fulfilled by our maternity services ever. Mm. I know that now. We've got more research than ever before, better research than ever before, more voices, more women speaking out about their amazing birth experiences and how they were achieved. And yet inside of our established maternity services, absolutely, it's an absolute dog's breakfast. It's a total mess. The midwives, honestly, you can barely find a midwife in a unit now. They're leaving in droves or they're just off sick.
Yeah.
For months. So I personally, my message has changed a bit. So now I started speaking just really directly to parents a few years back. I just thought, midwives aren't listening. they're just judging me. They don't care. I'm a bit of a loudmouth anyway. I piss people off. It's fine. You don't have to listen to me. So I started speaking directly to parents, you know, just in my social media, really. But more and more midwives are leaving the service. And I wanted them to be there because there are many, many people that don't have the budget to acquire really great care at the in the moments that they're pregnant. So it's, you know, I would have loved to know that people could go into maternity services and that will unusually receive great care that's evidence-based, physiologically sound, etc. But they're not. And so, no. You know, my message is mutating over the months now to realise, oh, gosh, like I receive a lot of birth stories. And the ones that go really, really well, oh, they're definitely at home. Are they free birth? What are you saying? Like that realization as well, because I know we've looked at the stats around free birth and, you know, free birth. Not just free birth. They usually lump in BBA with free birth. Mm. And then, you know.
Before arrival, I'm just going to clarify that for anyone listening who doesn't know what a BBA is.
Yeah, thank you. I've got to try and make sure I do that. They usually throw that in and then it skews the outcomes because the parents aren't prepared. It wasn't, you know, there's a bit of a panic or the baby born on the side.
Born in the car park before they got to the hospital. So they're on hospital premises, but technically born before arrival into the maternity.
Into the maternity unit.
With a midwife. So
in a room.
Yeah. On the M25.
Yeah, on the M25.
Not really a chosen birth. So those stats are not really going to...
They're not going to hold up. It's not going to look as if birth is safe.
No, because they were planning to actually have a, you know, straightforward, in quotes, hospital birth.
Yeah, exactly. And it just outcomes, you know, long-term outcomes, you know, chances of the baby having HIE, which somebody tell me what that means. I'm trying to think of the words. Ischemic encephaly, hypoxic ischemic encephaly.
That's yes. It.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, all of us were going, oh God, I just know the acronym. It's great that all of us did that.
Yeah, all of us. Because we're used to just.
We haven't got our notes in front of us. We can't go with Rachel going, hold on, just going to look it up, cut this bit. And I'm like, hold on, let's just look at the notes. Wait, let me scroll. Hold on, it's on my phone. It's really small. I need my glasses. Cut. This takes me so long to bloody edit when there's just the two of us.
Oh my God, stop it. Hilarious. But yeah, so there's no time to scroll for that one. That no. Came from us, our pure genius.
Pure genius. Three of us to go,
You can cut that bit out.
No. That's what makes it real. No,
she keeps them all in.
But, I keep the ones I like.
You keep the ones you like. Oh my goodness! I'm not
the ones that make me look bad. All.
Oh, Rachel, you're being bullied by Kate.
She's such a liar. She's just like.
Oh no! This is so naughty. I had a feeling we're just going to do this. I just sit there crying, laughing when I'm listening to your podcast, or literally crying. You know, but, especially I think you've got somebody, Kumar
Ashi.
That episode, I had to listen to it in chunks. I was so upset. I just love the energy that you bring. But you know, if it's a BBA, you've got a higher chance of HIE. That, you know, that's what most of the evidence says. So people lump that in with free birth and say free birth's really dangerous, whilst you've got these families that prepare so well. And you know, and it reflects in the outcome. They have some really great outcomes. Mm. Sometimes there's like a retained placenta, or what we would say is a retained placenta. But on the other hand, you know, those of us that work outside the system, we haven't got the 1 hour cutoff for physiological because it's not really real. It's not real.
You've got Rachel's face.
What did I touch your nerve, Rachel?
Just time frames in general.
Yeah. Time frames, you know, even now, I'm a bit sad to see time frames being woven into breech birth, because really it's just more nuanced than that, you know. And I just think it it takes us a step backwards in our reteaching of breach skill and breach knowledge and breach intuition.
But people like time frames. I get that all of the time when I'm teaching. Yeah, but how long? How long? How long before the birth of the baby's head and the birth of the baby's body? Like, and it's an unanswerable question, because for, you know, one baby it might be 2 minutes, another baby might be half an hour. You can't, you just can't, there isn't a time frame. And yet we're taught that because we're almost, you know, flow charts and numbers, it's the lowest common denominator. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about, you know, hospital midwifery versus, and I don't like to verse because, you know, it should be the same across settings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, over here, they've changed the rules around home birth midwifery so that in order to be endorsed to be a home birth midwife, you now have to have done, is it 500, however many hours in a hospital setting. As if, you know, you go and you do your real midwifery. I know. So you graduate, then you do your real midwifery in a hospital setting so that you can have all those important skills to then go and be a home birth midwife. And it's like, no, it should be the other way around.
I don't need to ask you. You were trained here in the UK, weren't you, Rachel? How much did you have to unlearn to be a safe midwife?
It's like, huge amount. I don't think I did it until I was an independent midwife. I know people get upset with the word independent midwife. I was an independent midwife because I was working independently. Because you're supposed to say private practice midwife, because independent makes it sound like you're a maverick off doing your own thing. The correct terminology is, but at the time that I was doing it, I was an independent midwife. And it took me years and women showing me all of the things that I'd got wrong, you know, all the things that I'd learned that actually weren't true.
So painful. I felt that. Yeah, it's so horrible. I mean, I put myself on a fast track, and I literally couldn't get out of my onesie for about 6 months when I realized how many babies, you know, when you did that Confessions of a Vampire Midwife blog, right? And it's just like, it was hitting so many nerves because, I also trained with a company to collect the baby's blood. It's not cord blood, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, so, you know, we had a similar history there and experience. But when I spent 6 months in a onesie is when I realised that I'd been cutting and clamping cords early.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, I can't go back.
I can't go back. It literally was that I'm not going back, and that's big, and it's irretrievable. It's a one-way trip. Once you deny that baby their entire blood supply, it's a one-way trip. They're compromised. They start off compromised. They have to build it back, and it gets built back, but they spend a few months with less iron than they're supposed to have, without the stem cells they're supposed to have, blah blah blah, right? So I can just imagine, you did your training, you then moved to another country, you brought the British midwifery training into the houses of people that trust you, and all sorts of faff is going on. As you
and then they told me that I didn't know anything.
And you're a difficult midwife, Rachel.
I am a difficult. I've always been a difficult woman.
Who said that? Do you know? I think I'm kind of. It makes me crush even harder, to be honest. If that's Rachel, it does, because I don't think we're called to be easy. I think we're gatekeepers for the most important experience we all have. Like getting here onto the planet, and why should we be easy? Like we're there to keep the gates. When have gatekeepers ever been easy?
You'd hope not, otherwise everyone'd be let in.
I want to be in.
I'm a bouncer going, sorry mate, nah, not with those trainers, you ain't coming in. See, we could all go into bouncing.
I think we could stop being so obsessed with families having better births. I definitely think there's a career for us. in dancing, because none of us are easy. This is what I've noticed.
But it's not easy to be not easy.
No.
And that's a really important thing.
No, you've got to accept that people don't like you. And that's like really, it can be difficult, especially when... Difficult. And you're wanting to feel safe. If you're in a hospital setting in particular with, you're working with a group of people, you want to be part of that group. And if by being difficult and, being true to yourself means that you're outsiding yourself, it can be tough. And that's why, so many midwives just swallow it up and carry on and it doesn't do them any good at all. And that's also why, when you're confronted, when you realize that something you've been doing is not the best thing, which is actually most of the things that I was taught to do as a midwife, when you realize that, hang on a minute, I probably shouldn't be shouting at women to push and I shouldn't be pulling on babies' heads. When you realize that you've got a choice, you can either, spend some time in your onesie feeling shit about it and going, okay, so that's something I did. I know better now. I'm going to move on and make sure other women have this information so that they don't have to have that. Or you just deny it and you go, no, what I did was perfectly fine. The babies are perfectly fine. I can't even go there. And you see a lot of midwives do that. And those are the midwives who then are, saying you're dangerous and I'm going to report you because what you're saying is really challenging them. Otherwise they wouldn't respond.
But I think they're also in a place of hurt. And that's our coping mechanism. And that's why it's so difficult to make that change, because when we're in a place of fear and hurt, they always say like the truth hurts. So what we either do is, exactly what you would do, or you go, I don't have any choice because I've spent however much money or time to train to be in this position. I'm now in the system 3 years in, 5 years, 25 years in. What are my prospects for getting another type of job? I have to retrain. I can see it from that point of just this feeling so stuck. And how do you protect yourself from going in every day and doing what you have heard and read or seen and know is wrong? And this doesn't make it right at all. But how do you protect your energy? How do you protect yourself and preservation to keep going into that job because you cannot afford to leave it? And that's what makes me so sad and so angry. And you're talking about the midwives that leave in droves. And I've got friends in the UK who have done that, are in that situation, but also the other way where they cannot leave. Not a case of, bugger this, I'm going in 6 months. I'm going to retire. I'm going to go and work in, I don't know, wherever. So how do you live with that when you're faced with these challenges every day that you walk into? And we've talked about this a lot, Rachel, like doing the little bit you can in your sphere of influence. And knowing that what you do within that room for that mother, for that family, for that cohort of people that you're with right then and there, you have to take that amount home and be able to go, okay, I did a good job as best I could with them. The rest of all the shit that's going on, I don't know.
And we can, you see, you're right. I also get the birth reports of women who manage, I call them gem midwives, like rare gem, hidden gem. But they're in there. I sometimes get letters from them saying, I want to leave, but who's going to do that for the women? If I'm not there, there's going to be 100% of them put on the conveyor belt rather than 99.
And that's the protector part of us coming in. That's why we never go on strike. We never strike for our pay because you can't just bring the Green Army in like you did with nursing and stuff.
Oh, please. You really can't.
We can't let that happen to the women we're with.
Exactly. And that's our protector part. Personally, I am a midwife who would strike. As in, I wouldn't continue. Well, basically nearly my whole career has been that. I'm not doing it. So I would just take them you know, into my van or something, say give birth in there. So I just do something different. I'd say, yeah, I serve you, but just not serving you in there. And that's become my life. And also I think they abuse the fact that we are nurturers and protectors. Oh, they'll never go on the fight. So they're literally killing us. You know, I was talking about this in a group of midwives the other day. You know, I before I was in accountancy, I was not at a memorial several times a year for my colleagues. When I became a midwife, I'm at a memorial several times a year for colleagues because they've died of, you know, terminal illnesses and sadly, one of them was because they threw themselves off of the top of the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not sure how far we can really continue to lean into this idea of being ever present, whatever the cost. I think we're suffering from vicarious abuse as well. I described to you what I saw when the midwife was pulling the umbilical cord over the baby's head. You know, the pictures I've seen in my head, you know, that I can talk about that now. I couldn't talk about it. So we're kind of going through this. And also, having been recently through a process of self-healing, finally acknowledging who I am, menopause triggered it. Brilliant. I've had the best menopause. And, you know, just, you know, listening to Jane, taking her advice, you know, it's healed me. And I'm now, oh, I'm such a kick-ass person to have in the birth space. I've always been a great person, but now I'm just like, oh man, like top grade birth keeper. But it's only because I've healed myself. So I just to say that my sisters and brothers who serve families but are serving under circumstances where they're hearing people screaming in a labor room, you know, hearing their colleagues shouting at people in labor rooms, cleaning up blood again, you know, emergency bell, responding to that several times a day, you can't tell me that that's a person functioning at their best, in their best health. You know, their adrenals are going to be completely shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it affects your judgment, affects your response time.
Mm-hmm.
So, we are, you know, as women, you know, the majority of us that serve as birth keepers and midwives are women and doulas, yeah, because they're going through mm-hmm. exactly the same thing. Yeah, it's just that they didn't mm-hmm. complete their midwifery training and get on a register. But, you know, there's many doulas that know more than some of our colleagues that are on the register. Yeah. So it's a mess. It's a mess because us saying we're going to be there no matter what, there's a cost. There's a cost. You know, we start lying to people to keep our jobs. You know, when is it ever going to be useful in maternity care to perpetuate deceit and crimes like coercion, assault and battery? We cannot keep lying to ourselves that this is going to end well. And it's not. It's cascading into the bin. Yeah, maternity service is just almost, it's on the edge of the bin, and it just needs just a, and it's in. So we can't continue to deny that this is the case. It's never the time to tell a lie to a vulnerable woman. And yet our colleagues are doing it 24/7.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. So let's, on the upside.
That's just giving me a moment I always get these moments, but it's when we speak to other people and it's like, because I've been out for a while and.
Carry on.
I've been out for a while, so it gives me that distance. But then every time we speak to someone or I speak to a colleague or I read reports in the newspaper and see what's going on and follow stuff online, and it just gets me. It's like that stab in the heart. And also it still takes me back to over 20 years ago. Like, I started out for a reason I worked in this big hospital, and then I was lucky enough to go to a really lovely hospital where there was quite a lot of home birth. There was a lot of powerful midwives Kemi, like Rachel, that were standing up for the rights. There was this powerful communication that worked in this sphere of, this is a protected space, we are the birth keepers, and you know, the collaboration with doctors was collaboration at most of the time. Not always, it's not possible, but it was a case of, we would go out, the senior midwife was highly respected, and then the doctors would talk with her, with you, outside, not in the room. And so I was able to have gone from this massive tertiary hospital conveyor belt, like basically did 6 months of beautiful home birth community team midwifery, and then after the first 6 months of training went into the hospital and went, I don't want to do this training anymore. Like, I never want to step foot in a hospital. The third birth I saw was a spontaneous vaginal birth. I'd seen a cesarean section. I'd seen a really not nice forceps before. And I just thought, I can't do this. And I knew that I couldn't stay there. And I was lucky to go into a team down in London in a smallish hospital and get some of that. And then I left and went to Australia and had my head turned around, but really, and then got into more breastfeeding, postnatal lactation, antenatal, more specialist. And I was able to be more autonomous because I was running breastfeeding clinics, postnatal clinics, and then set up a community visiting. So I've had that distance, but every so often would sort of dip back in, discuss with my colleagues and go, oh God. And it takes my breath away. And I just have thought, I can't go back into that anymore. It's like a war zone sometimes for the midwives themselves and for all of the staff working, and then all the families you work with.
All the families. I mean,
they shouldn't have to deal with that.
Families, no, they shouldn't. And I think as well, part of the, you know, is it planned or is it an accident we've got here? But I think it might be a plan. But, you know, I just see that when women escape with their babies in their arms, you know, when they talk about, you know, getting sprung out of postpartum care or the postnatal ward, etc., for them to start their lives as mothers with those thoughts and then not receive the support when they're back in the community and all of the knock-ons that come from that. How do we expect to have a strong society? You know, how do we expect these babies to become strong adults when their parents have been dismantled during pregnancy and birth? You know, I brought in words like grooming. I used the word grooming. Like, I could have sworn I heard Rachel use it once as well. So I now admit it's grooming. You know, if you start engaging, you know, once you're pregnant, it starts from before you're pregnant. It starts from childhood. But if you participate in that grooming, you're not going to be in a really good position to be able to rescue a good birth out of maternity services, because you've been pounded into dirt. So imagine you then go through the labour and birth process where and then get gaslighted by the people that you're supposed to trust, and then go out into the community and have no support. And so the bonding and breastfeeding goes up the spout, and then it's like you know, having a broken ankle, you know, then walking through life, and you're not quite even. You start to have referral pain, you know, in other parts of your muscles. You know, one calf becomes bigger than the other, etc. We compensate, and then we just kind of limp through life like that, and our children limp through life with, you know, having begun of only 2/3 of their blood complement, got bad guts because they, you know, or suboptimal gut flora because they didn't pass through the vagina like they could have done if you hadn't induced the labour. You know, it's just like all the knock-ons. You know, the pain that you're expressing, Katie, is, you know, you're feeling pain for the people who are the survivors of the crimes and the perpetrators of the crimes, and and the fact that they're probably in denial that they're perpetrating crimes. It is crime, coercion, assault and battery. They're all crimes and you're doing them every day. Mm-hmm. Colleagues, you're doing it every day, right? So whilst you're in denial of that and continue to do that, you continue to be part of the problem. When you face it and it's painful and it's visceral and you and it's you, it physically manifests when you face that, you'll survive, but then you've got to think about what you're going to do. What are you going to do about that? Mm-hmm. So like your response is, you know, world renowned. We know what you guys are doing about it. You talk about it openly and you're there being a part of the solution openly. You've got that gem midwife that manages to stay in there and, you know, say, oh, she's got an anterior lip and all the other ways we use to try and get more time for, you know, we know it's a lie. Right? So, yeah, so we know she's full of, okay? But, you know, you report, yeah, she's nine or an anterior lip. But, you know, they should keep an audit on the unit saying, my God, there's so many women that when they're assessed, you know, happen to be nine or an anterior lip. But, you know, we've got all those things, but we're still lying. We're still denying the fullness of our skill and our experience and lying to survive and to hold space for the woman.
And that sustains the system. That's sustaining the system.
Exactly. Rather than. So now I'm the annoying one. So we've all been seen to be quite irritating. Right?
Difficult women.
It's a badge of honour, okay? I now love to include in the conversation or leave the conversation with, we're all grown-ups, you know, we can make choices. And, you know, particularly with parents, I like to facilitate the discussion of them making choices. Like, you don't have to go into labour ward. Oh, but they said that I'm old. You don't have to go into labour wards. And then giving them examples of people, like I've looked after people in their 50s, etc., having their first birth, giving examples of that, you know, giving examples. So many people I've looked after that have had assisted conception, you know, so, you know, most of my colleagues say, oh, right, yeah, you have to be induced at 40 weeks because your placenta is going to pop off. You know, I tell them the truth. That's all I do. I just tell them the truth. And they say, oh, have you seen it? Hundreds of times. All right, I'll give it a go then. I say, yeah, you've got the hospital 5 minutes up the road. You know, you throw a stick, you hit 8 hospitals in London. So you're hospital up the road. You can go there. You know, there's it's like I there was an article that a blog that Rachel wrote. She really was so pissed off when she was saying that some women. But most women are better off having managed the third stage, right? What are you doing? Till I read the article, the full article, she's bloody right. Yeah, of course, in those circumstances, you're probably going to end up needing it because you've got, you know, the tea trolley, you know, rattling past. You've got someone screaming like they're on fire across the hall and stuff like that. Yeah, that makes sense. So that, you know, then... You present the information to people in an unbiased way, and then they can make a choice. Oh, how can I avoid having syntocin or syntometrin? You could consider a home birth, but it's just having those conversations gives people, and then reminding them you can choose to give birth in Piccadilly Circus if you want to. It's not going to be great for your physiology.
It'll end up on YouTube.
Thank you. That, the uploads, can you imagine? Can you imagine the comments?
Wonderful.
But that's how I kind of operate now. It's like you've always got choices. Oh, yeah, there's this information, this information. You know you've got a choice. Do you know it'd work better if you did this? You know, they've said I can't have a home birth and then I'll separate it out. I said, oh, you mean they said that they won't attend your home birth? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's all I'm doing. And I think it's really helping. When people try and have the conversation with me, you know, like sometimes I get invited to forums to discuss how we can improve the maternity services. I cut that short. I just say, it's not going to, we can't improve it. It's broken. Finish. And then I kind of pound it home and say, actually, it's not broken. It's designed this way. We can't give birth in it. It's not fit for purpose. You're going to have another plan.
And what's the response?
Oh, people get really pissed off with me.
Is that people in the system, or is that also, you know, lay people, people in the community? Yeah. Like, is there a different response compared to whether it's someone who's a midwife or someone who's pregnant?
This is another thing that I've learned. You really can't judge a book by its cover, its gender, its, you know, its colour. You can't, because my allies in this message have come from all over. Mm. They're from all over. It's always unexpected. It really is. That's why, you know, some people say, oh, men aren't fit for the birth space. I say, what are you talking about? Like, some of the best midwives I know are male. Yeah. It comes from all over, unexpected places, obstetricians. They say, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's not, we're not going to be able to fulfill it here. It's a wrap. Yeah. And it's good.
No, I'm just really keen to find out about the handing in your registration thing, because so in us, there's been a whole wave, particularly with COVID and big shifts and things happening in Australia, of midwives wanting to do this. But I don't know whether it's the same in the UK as here. So the situation here is, if you are a birth keeper, if you're not a registered care provider, then in most states, there are a couple of states where you can't, but you can attend a birth, and that's not a, it's not an issue. It's not a legal problem at all. However, if you have been a midwife before, there is a precedent set that if anything happens, you will be judged as a midwife because you were a midwife, even if you're not a midwife. So that's what's going on here. So there's a lot of midwives kind of wanting to step out, but going, oh, what's that going to look like? Because historically in Australia, we could still end up being judged in a court of law as a, according to the standards of a midwife, like we're registered.
But that was a criminal case, was it? That where the precedent was
set? No.
No.
It was a coronial inquest and a criminal inquest.
Okay.
And there's been two. So there's been a few situations in Australia where this has kind of bubbled up.
Yeah, that's a problem. Here, once you're off the register, there has been no precedent set yet. I mean, for acting like a midwife. And hopefully
whatever that is.
Well, exactly. I regularly go off looking to see if someone's bothered to write it down. What are these protective functions? And
well, in Australia, somebody did, and it included, and now I can't remember in time, there's a whole list of things, but one of them included putting your fingers beyond the anal verge.
Wow.
So that's midwifery practice.
If you've got your fingers off to that, I'm begging you to send it to me. I'm begging you. Is that during labour? Is that during, you know, fanny fun? Like what?
That's a midwifery skill we go about talking about on people's anal verges, apparently.
I must have slept through that lecture. I would like to send me a link to it when you find it, please.
Does that mean that we have to start doing that now?
That means we have to start doing it. I don't have to because I'm not on the register. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, protected functions, what are they? Until Rachel's enlightened me. I haven't seen the list, right? I've had some, you know, and it's not been setting precedent here in the UK either, what that is. Yes, there's a £5,000 fine for us if we've been seen to be acting like midwives. And I'm guessing if we're at a breech birth and we attempt, anyone, if anyone is at a breech birth and attempts to resolve it, you know, not just catching the baby, but attempts to resolve it, and harm is caused to the baby, I guess there's grounds there for a criminal case. But once you're off the register, it doesn't matter that you were on it, you're no longer on it. So you're not held to anything that the Nursing and Midwifery Council say. And, you know, adding a cheeky aside, that people that are on the register are not following the code either. They're not.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
No, they're not. But they're fine because they're employed by the NHS. See, so that's where who your employer is. And actually, your what you have signed to the Crown to protect and uphold, you know, people are going with what their employer says. You know, like it's okay to lie to a woman and tell her that a sweep isn't an induction. It's okay to do that, yeah? So just to say that here, we've got the precedent for saying you are acting like a midwife, but nobody actually really knows what that is. You've got the potential for a £5,000 fine, but that's it. So it's much
clearer. Cycling about on a bike with a cardigan, that would be acting like a midwife in England,
wouldn't it? Do you know there's an actual fact. One of my exes pointed out to me that it sounds like I've had loads.
Doesn't matter if you have.
And true. Right, yeah. But I happen to have been obsessed with this for too long to have had much of a sex life. But pointed out that a lot of independent midwives protect their necks in some way. Very interesting. Ooh. So I said, really? So I went to conferences and I found that a lot of us had scars.
They do.
See?
This independent midwives.
Yes.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
So are they protecting their throat chakra from speaking out?
Yes.
Well, because we're the witches.
And we do, but we then just cover our necks. It's kind of a dichotomy we're in. Like, we know we have to speak, but actually, remember what happened last time? You know.
Just a few years back.
Just a few years back. Yeah. So
it makes you feel vulnerable.
It's really interesting, isn't it? So, yeah. But are we off piece? What's happened? Where are we?
We're at next golf and witch burning.
Ah, right. Yeah. And the ducking stool. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And all the rest.
Yeah, and the rest. Yeah. Can I just throw in there? I think actually you've probably already discussed it, and we don't have to discuss it. But that again, during that time, it was mostly women that were ratting on other women.
Yes. Yeah?
So that's
to protect themselves.
That's part of the wound. So,
but isn't that what we're still doing? Isn't that why it's so painful?
That's what I was going to say. I've had a portion of my career where I have been really angry with my sisters and like saying, how could you? And it was definitely a witch wound. I now realise that we're doing so much better by having collaboration. And there's whenever we collaborate, obviously there's that fear or potentially. I mean, I as I said, I've had to work on myself. Everyone does. But, you know, I've now done it. And it's work in progress and it continues. But now, rather than resisting, trusting colleagues and the sisterhood and to protect myself, rather than, and I've let go of my scarf around my neck. It's occasionally there, but now it's a minority of the time. I now choose to trust spirit, trust my calling, trust where I'm going and open my heart. And to collaborations and things. And I definitely can feel movement because of that. When it was very polarized and I was like, you're hurting women. There's just more of a divide, obviously. But now that I'm actually saying, yeah, I get where you're coming from. And we can't hurt women, you know. It's just easier to accept. It's easier to receive and mull over. So outside of the
system, I need to do some work.
Come in, the water's lovely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to set a bar in, and it, you know, it's just a little personal crusade that when we enter the birth space, we have to be competent in certain things. So I don't want to swing the other way to, oh, you just wander in a floaty dress and it'll be fine. I feel like we should, I think it should be common knowledge, but particularly if you're in a birth space as a birth keeper, to know how to act around a hemorrhage. You know, I think it should be common knowledge, but particularly if you're in the birth space, to, you know, not pull on a baby's legs if they're coming in breech because you're going to straighten their spine and cause a problem. I think we should all know that, you know, you know, we should all really know how to reach in and remove an arm, you know, say for babies, you know, inside like that. You know, I know my focus on breech, but we should all know how to act appropriately if there's a, some, you know, like one of your very eminent, beautiful birth keepers was at a birth of a surprise twin. So, you know, and it happens, yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. So if you're a birth keeper, you have to know how to act appropriately in case there's another baby that you weren't expecting, you know. So that's me at the moment, just my personal thing. I'm thinking, okay, we're unregulated. But, you know, let your own heart guide you into acquiring as much knowledge and experience and submitting, in inverted commas, to apprenticeship, you know, knowing where you need assistance. It's like at the moment, I still wouldn't massage an abdomen in pregnancy to facilitate the positioning of the baby. I wouldn't. But I'm not trained and it's not my culture, right? However, there are cultures around the world that enabling spontaneous birth to happen in home settings at a higher rate because they use massage in pregnancy to facilitate optimal fetal positioning. I want to learn it. So that's, you know, one of the things I'm doing when I'm out of the country. I want to learn it. So I'm not saying work outside of your scope of knowledge, practice and experience, but I am saying perhaps submit ourselves to learning new skills, reviving old skills, and being a help, not a hindrance in birth spaces. You know, not sitting there with a baby that's, you know, white, floppy, and saying, oh, the baby's just coming too. You know, just give them a chance to transition across the world. It's like, no, the baby needs help, right? So that's where I'm at the moment. So, you know, I'm thinking about retreats, you know, so that we can all get in there and learn skills. And it's definitely not something that we are excluding the doulas, you know, because you haven't been a midwife, because there are many, many doulas that have availed themselves of these skills. But, you know, when I used to go to Mary Cronk's breech training, the majority of the room was filled with doulas, not midwives. And it's not because the midwives know it all, because most midwives don't know how to.
But this is because it was taken away from us.
Yeah.
In the hospital setting.
But also, so when I started kind of doing a lot of speaking across Australia, the people who would come and, like, you know, people say, oh, you're speaking to the converted. Well, yes, I am. I actually can't be bothered to speak to the other ones. Like, you know.
Oh, yes. Ding, ding, ding.
not wasting my voice. No. But it was predominantly doulas and birth keepers. It was not registered midwives turning up, unless it was a midwife event. But these things like skills workshops or just, you know, any other thing that was outside of kind of the registered midwife world was predominantly non-registered practitioners. That's changed. So that gives me a little bit of hope, because now there's way more registered midwives coming.
Very true.
But it wasn't.
No, it was so fringe.
A whole load of midwives now who are going, I think there might be something that's outside of this kind of mainstream stuff that I've been fed. There's another way of doing things. And I think midwives are keen to reclaim that.
I'd say better. It's a better way of doing things. Yeah, I would. Definitely looking at the physiology and, you know, I've constantly got my Don and Pelvis out. Just, you know, I know there's better ways of trying to think through a problem, but I just start there. in trying to figure out, like Kiko, for instance, knees in, calves out. Now, everyone's running around saying knees in, calves out, knees in. And actually, no, there's a nuance there. It's like when we discovered things like the hip squeeze or started bringing that into our practice. You know, do people be hip squeezing all over the place? You've got a problem there. Brim in, outlet out. Yeah. So you could be squeezing the baby literally where they don't want to be squeezed. Right. So it's that kind of stuff. But I think when we're prepared to expose ourselves to that kind of learning, we are learning better skills for sure.
Yes.
It's better.
Well, everything should be based on the foundations of understanding any birth, including complicated birth, is physiology. You have to understand physiology to understand what's different when it's not working.
That's right.
The pathology.
That's right.
And I think the foundations of understanding anything that's going on and culturally, socially, is history or her story.
Yes.
Because if you can understand the her story of how the system was set up, you can understand why it's functioning the way it is and why it's not going to change anytime soon without a massive tearing it out and starting again, you know, restarting the culture.
Yeah, restarting, definitely. I mean, your book that you wrote, Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage, there are a lot of, that's in the hands of a lot of establishment midwives. That book has reached them. In Your Own Time, Sarah Wickham, wow. You know, like those two books have reached them. And so I still don't think, it's still not the majority of them. So I still don't think we can change the system, but I definitely think that the seeds are being planted for something new and different. And so that's the space we're in at the moment. I'm hoping to, at some point, there's so many things I want to do, of course, but I'd like to convene a round table of the thinkers. You know, when your blog is called Midwife Thinking, so I had to go back there, but I just said, yes, that's right. That's the missing bit. We've not been thinking. I just want the thinkers to get together, people that can handle change, to think about what we're going to have ready for parents as the rat's gone off the sinking ship, kind of thing. So, I'm feeling very hopeful. I think as I said. For sure. Please don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about fixing the current system we have. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am really hopeful that we can create something and with parents that is going to serve them well. I'm very excited.
My only other question would be, I think we've covered it, would be like, you know, the midwives who see what's happening and they see the sinking ship. And we're talking about we need to scrap the ship and start over. Where do they go from now? How do they make the leap that you've made? Or how do they manage this or not manage this? I don't know, just like what the hell? Because we are getting so many DMs.
No, I would agree. And what that looks like is handing in your notice, working bank whilst you do something else so you can keep your wheels spinning on your home. Keeping your hand in by listening to podcasts, maybe asking if there's a local dealer that wants an additional pair of hands, because if you're not registered, you are free. So you can go to birth to make tea or look after the other children, or if you want to keep your hand in. And then as you begin to see what you haven't been seeing in your previous role was, oh, look, birth unfolded, the baby fell out. You know, once you see that a few times, then you can start to think about, okay, what can I bring to the party? You know, what do I need to leave behind? The unlearning it took me years. Okay, so the unlearning takes a while. Whilst you're doing that, you know, try not to make a mess, humble yourself, be in birth spaces doing things that you can manage. But, you know, just there's a lot of unlearning. So you have to be there with other doulas, other birth keepers, and be apprenticed. But meanwhile, keep food on the table, doing whatever else you do. Like for me, it might have been DJing. I used to earn money as a DJ. You know, I don't mind saying it. Like people say, what? Like, yeah, and get paid. So, you know, that might be how I keep food on the table. Thankfully, you know, it's not, that's not been my journey, because I've always been willing to be apprenticed. So I was being apprenticed whilst I was still as a student midwife. I knew that it wasn't cutting it. So it's just, it's just humbling yourself. You have a registration. Apparently they call you a midwife. Newsflash, you're not. You're an obstetric nurse. If you want to become a midwife, you're going to need to learn how to not fuck up a birth. That's the cold, hard truth. When midwives contact me and say they're losing their minds, and then I remind them, you actually are losing your mind, because you're being vicariously abused.
Yes, vicarious PTSD.
Yeah, so you're feeling it. That's right, exactly. That's the proper term. You're feeling it because it is. Yep. So first, you've got to learn to trust your own feelings. And that could be, you know, choosing fruit with your eyes closed at a fruit stand. You know what I mean? You've got to start working with bringing back parts of yourselves that you've spun off into the atmosphere to cope. Mm-hmm. You've got to bring it all back. You've got to bring back your anger, bring back your despair. Yep. You know, you've got to bring it all back. You've got to reintegrate yourself and then say, right, now I feel I might just be a safe pair of hands and a safe heart for families. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. You might need to just, you know, do night shelf filling or something to keep food on the table. You're worth it. You're worth it. And the families you're going to serve are worth it. It's worth it. Rachel and I, you know, being about how to optimize birth is seen as the acute phase of the whole childbirth cycle. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people that are craving to know what we know. Well, and some people that want us to shut up as well. But there's a lot of people that are craving to know what we know. Okay. However, as I keep reminding people, we are postpartum for life. Like the way my postpartum unfolded was literally a dog's breakfast. And it has affected my whole life, even affected how I went into menopause, affected my, you know, my relationship breakdown, everything. Okay. So, and it affects the health of the infant that will be optimally fed from my breast. So if I haven't got any oxytocin, so I can't shoot milk at my infant because I'm, you know, I've got PTSD, which I did. Yeah. It's going to affect his health, you know, the obesity rates, everything, you know, the gut health, the whole shebang.
And all the shit we don't even know yet, because no one really wants to put any money in research, in breastfeeding.
Oh, yeah, who wants to know about that? But, you know, it became my son's reality. He's 31 and finally healed his gut. But it was a big, long, painful journey. So you being in your power there is so important. For decades.
Exactly. However, we have to work together, but we're in silos.
This is another reason why you guys bringing this together is so amazing. And like when you flung down that skin to skin episode, it's like, ooh, mind blowing. I hope you got the answer. I hope I broke it down enough. Sometimes we have our calling, but you're just going to have to do something else until you can stop being a menace in the birth space. And you can do both. There's 24 hours in a day.
Thank you so much for being on with us. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
It has. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this insightful, challenging, and passionate episode. Please do share this on your socials and tell your friends. Oh my goodness, I get the goosebumps when I read your reviews. Thank you, they make my day. And if you listen on a platform where you can't leave a review, then please share a story on your socials or tell a few friends to listen in. Sit them down and make them listen. Everyone needs some nuggety goodness. You can also support us to keep making episodes by donating to our Patreon page. All the details of this are in the show notes, as well as over on our Instagram at The Midwives Cauldron. Thank you to all of you for your ongoing support. We are so thrilled to have you with us in the cauldron. We will see you next time with another ripper of an episode. So, of course, this just leaves us with the bloopers.
Hello!
Hi, good morning!
Good morning!
Are you dressed?
I'm dressed. Rachel's very dressed.
I'm dressed.
But I have a camera issue that will not record my camera. So I've just put Rachel on WhatsApp. So I wondered whether I could put you on WhatsApp if you wanted to see me. It's easier.
Yeah, if you can. But is that recording?
No, it won't record the WhatsApp. It will just record this. So it'll just record our voices.
Do you use the video?
No.
Yeah. We don't use the video, but it's nice to see your face, Katie, so we can see your expression.
I just need to get your number, so as long as you don't mind me having your number.
No, happy to. Do you want me to tap it in the chat? I'm going to cut that a bit out, right?
No, I'm leaving that in. This is what our new plan is, to get everyone's phone numbers details.
We'll just broadcast it and tell anybody who's in labour to ring you at any time.
Oh my God, Rachel.
So can you do three people in WhatsApp?
Oh yeah, you can do like a party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I deleted it off my phone.
Did you?
I have to find it again.
Yes, yeah, so Rachel had to then log in to get this going.
Yeah.
Wow, this is the smoothest
so
podcast that we've done for a long time.
So impressed.
Just wanted to really give you the full experience.
Yeah, I'm getting the full experience. You succeeded, okay? Unbelievable. I can't find you on WhatsApp, Katie.
Yeah, so, and I can't find you. So weird. You know what'll happen after we've completed this interview?
Yeah, the whole thing.
It will all pop up. And I'm going to send you a message and a picture of my face.
Do that. You've got a very expressive voice.
Thank you, lovely.
Now I'm just reading all these messages that were on WhatsApp that have been coming through when it's been deleted.
All right, we'll do that later.
Rachel wants to do it now.
Just go through that for the first 10 minutes. Wait while Rachel does her WhatsApp messages.
Do it now.
Great timing. Fantastic. Yeah. Brilliant.
I think there's one here from my son. It's not certainly not for me. That's a bit odd. Anyway.
Brilliant.
Good morning. Welcome to the chaos.
Thanks. Yes. Welcome to. Like, we even got on early to just check.
I know.
It's you.
Yeah, to double check. It's taken us this long to get this far.
That's very responsible of you. We'll work it out.
Well, that's why we can't even get to work it out when it's taken us 20 minutes. So, you're on WhatsApp.
You found me.
Yep. And I'm calling you, and then I'm going to call Rachel and add her in.
Oh, got you! Right, am I supposed to have answered?
Yes. Okay. But then put yourself, hello! Hello?
Katie! Hello!
Oh, I turned the video off. That doesn't help. That's the point. Okay, let's add Rachel.
I'm a cute little face.
Join. Yay!
Okay, so someone mute. Everyone mute.
Okay,
oh, yeah,
what are we muting on WhatsApp?
Okay,
can do that. Done. Yay!
Marvellous technology.
We did it between us. Look at that.
We did it. Look at that. And what is it? 9:09.
My God. So impressed.
Amazing.
Wondering which of my courses is for you?
Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.